The only purpose for his life could be to serve as a warning to others. It's the Drew Marshall Show.
Tim, you can't play this song on Christian radio. There's backward masking in it.
We're stupid.
I wonder if they listen to this one at Wheaton.
No. Backwards.
Yeah. Yes, what is that, friend? It's a devil. Is that a pack heat? Or is that, what's that?
Wrong school.
Oh, really?
It's Liberty. It was pack and heat.
Yeah. Well, sorry about that.
Hey, it's time to move on. We're a little late. Sorry, we're rattling on too much. Dr. John C. Wathey. He's the author of The Illusion of God's Presence, The Biological Origins of Spiritual Longing. It is our privilege to introduce to you this is an authentic, smart listener of the Drew Marshall. We didn't think we had any. And this gentleman
is kind of an oxymoron.
Is smart and a listener of the Drew Marshall Show. Sir, you need help. No question.
Hi there.
How are you? And it's Wathey, correct?
Yeah, yes, you got that right.
Good. I'm sure everybody says Wathey like I may have said earlier. I apologize for that. So listen, this book came out of your brain as a result of what?
It's kind of a long story, but the essence of it is I've personally had the experience of what many people call the feeling of God's presence or the sense of God's presence. But I'm a biology nerd by training and an atheist ever since I was a teenager, really. So by the time I actually had this sensation of God's presence, I wasn't religious anymore. And even though it was a very compelling sensation, profoundly compelling and moving and highly emotional, I saw it through the lens of biology. So I see it through, I think the feelings are real, and I empathize very much with religious people who say they have felt God's presence and they believe because they know God is real, they've felt his presence. The feelings are real. I just don't think the religious or supernatural interpretation of them is real. I've tried to interpret it in a biological way. You may know the phrase that's commonly used in popular religious literature, that we have this God-shaped hole in our hearts and minds. And why would God give us this God-shaped hole if he didn't want us to fill it? Why would it be there if there was no God? Surely this is proof that there is a God, that we have this innate longing for God. And what I try to argue in the book is that, yes, there is this thing, there is this spiritual longing that I think is innate, but it's not a God-shaped hole, it's a mother-shaped hole. It's something that's there because of some of the strange constraints of human infancy, and it also has something to do with our nature as highly social animals, as adults.
So, hold on. This is a huge statement you've just made. You believe that when there is spiritual longing in people, we have said that's a God-shaped hole that can only be filled by God. And you're saying, no, it's a mother-shaped hole.
Yes. The basic idea is that human infants are born completely helpless and dependent on their mothers. And I'm arguing that evolution has selected in us, or has created in our brains, this innate circuitry that causes a human infant to expect the existence of its mother, to know that she provides warmth and nourishment and love, and to know that she responds to crying. It's sort of the skeleton of the infant's part of the mother-infant bond. It's just enough to cause the infant to reach out and to expect the existence of this other being on whom its life depends. That would be a very fitting thing in view of the other many other animals that have something like this. It's very common in biology to find animals that are born or that hatch out with some innate neural program that's just tailored to suit the animal's needs, to have it do something that it absolutely needs to do right from the beginning to survive. So that's kind of where the idea comes from. There's a little more to it than that, but that's the essence of it.
Okay, let's go back to this life-threatening hike that triggered your own mystical experience, because that sounds, you got to tell us more about that.
I had a feeling you'd ask me about the most embarrassing part of the book. yes. Okay, What happened was my brother and his family came to visit us, and I wanted very much to take them on this wonderful hike that my wife and I had done just a few months earlier. The only problem was it was summer, and this hike was in the desert. And unless you're an idiot, you don't go hiking in the desert in the summer. But unfortunately, this was my day to be an idiot, and I really wanted to show them this place because it was a wonderful place, spectacular scenery and everything. And I just kind of rationalized it away. I said, well, it's only 5 miles. We'll leave early. We'll bring a lot of water. It'll be okay.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't okay. It was 115 degrees Fahrenheit, which for you guys is 46 Celsius. So that's really hot.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we were about halfway through the hike, we started to get sick. And some people were getting a little confused and disoriented, throwing up. And when we had about a mile left to go, we had run out of water. And I was that's when I kind of knew we were in trouble. And the young folks in the party went ahead. They were going to start the air conditioner in the car and start to cool off that way. But I kind of lagged behind with my brother, who was the sickest of us, and he was having a lot of trouble. He was collapsing and saying, oh, just let me rest. I need to rest. And I tried to pull him and keep him moving. And suddenly it dawned on me that he could lose consciousness. And if he loses consciousness, no way I'm going to get him up that last hill to the car. I can't carry him. I can't drag him. The other people in the car are almost as sick and weak as we are. And if I drive the car down that hill, it'll get stuck in the sand, and that would kill all of us. So what would I do? Would I leave him to die to save the rest of us? And that was just about the most horrible thing that had ever gone through my mind, just the thought of having to make that decision. And you might think that that's where my mystical experience happened, but it wasn't. The short story is we all did get out alive, so the story had a happy ending. Except that that night I could not sleep. I was tortured by guilt and horror about this stupid thing I had done, almost killing my loved ones. And about 4 in the morning, I pulled down a book from the shelf about forgiveness and started reading the chapter about forgiving yourself. And it was a very moving thing, and I started to I just broke down and cried. And it was in that moment that I suddenly felt this presence, this being that was watching me and loving me and wanting to help me. And it was so real, so compelling that I felt that I could have just reached out and touched it. It was that real. And
that wasn't God.
And I don't think it was. I can understand how almost anybody having that experience would have no choice but to say, that has to be God.
Sure.
Now, if you're Muslim, it would be Allah. If you're Hindu, it might be Vishnu. But, you know, whatever culture you're in, you know, the relevant God is the one that you would fit into that God-shaped hole. But I had had feelings sort of like this before. I was raised as a Christian since I was age 4, and my parents took me to Sunday school regularly. So I had had these kinds of feelings before, never this intense, never this dramatic, but I'd had some inklings of this before. So I'd already had a chance to think about this before, and like I said, I thought about it through this lens of biology that I see the world through, and I had already had this idea that this is something infantile. This is the way a newborn infant sees the world. This is a feeling for that vague primordial savior that must be out there somewhere that I think every infant feels. So no, I'm still an atheist. It didn't persuade me, but I'm very empathetic towards people who do have those feelings. I can understand how they feel about it. I just, like I said, I don't think the supernatural part is
right.
Correct.
Right. I'm just looking at Tim here. Tim,
yeah.
Your face told me something.
Yeah, you know, we live in a very bipartisan political world. I know in the States it's that way too, and it's almost like, you know, even if Obama, and just because he's in administration now,
where are you going with this?
Wait a second. Even if Obama came up with the most brilliant thing to solve the world's problems, the Republicans in principle would just say he's an idiot.
So you're saying I'm just asking
if that potentially can play a part in the fact that you are saying it isn't God. Like, I'm not accusing you of anything.
We see what we want to see.
Yeah. Could that be playing into it?
Well, you're quite right that people do tend to color their perception. I mean,
that's what you're saying about religious people. If religious people had this experience, they would say it was God. And ipso facto, you would say it's not God.
Yes, and you're right. We do, and scientists do this too. We do color our perceptions with our preconceived notions, with our model of the world, with the way we've come to understand the world. So yes, that's a fair criticism. The only thing I would say in response to that is that in science, we have this very strong attitude, ethic. I'm not sure exactly what you call it, but I guess you could say it's Occam's razor. It's the principle that you go for the simplest explanation.
Right.
And
but you're not saying the simplest explanation for that overwhelming feeling of someone looking out for you thing. Are you saying the simplest explanation is that it's your mother?
Not that it's my mother, but it's that it's some wiring in my brain that expects mother.
Hmm.
It's an infantile expectation of the existence of mother, what I call the innate neural model of mother. So, to give you another analogy, if you explain lightning in terms of an electrostatic discharge, does that disprove that lightning comes from Thor's hammer hitting his invisible anvil up in the sky? Well, strictly speaking, no. Thor could still be up there. But isn't it really a lot more plausible to just discard all of that and say, you know, if there's a natural explanation, we should go with that? Chances are it really is an electrostatic discharge.
Hmm.
So that's kind of my feeling about this, too.
When it comes to, for example, up next is Bob Millett, and Bob is one of the world's leading scholars, Mormon scholars, okay? And one of the things that Mormons say is they talk about the burning bosom of their soul. I know that what I know is true because I can feel it, and you can't change how I feel about things. So we're talking about a feeling reaction to an event versus a cognitive reaction to an event. And, sir, you are a very wise gentleman. You are a neuroscientist of some kind, is that correct?
Of some kind, yes.
Yeah. So I'm not even going to try to explain what you do because it hurt my brain just reading your bio. But obviously, now this is going to sound like, you know, because you're so smart, you don't have feelings. And I'm not saying that. I'm not. Because that would mean that the opposite would be true about me. I'm such an idiot that I should be the most feeling person in the world. Well, we know I'm not.
That you're idiot or feeling?
Stop it.
Okay.
So this book is really for those in academia? Or is this book to be handed to those who are struggling with their faith? You followed my journey. What do you want me to really know, John?
It's definitely not written for academics, although if an academic wants to read it, I think they'll find what they're looking for in the endnotes. I pushed all that stuff into the endnotes, but it's written for anybody who's sort of bright and knows kind of the average degree of scientific literacy. So I did have a hope that some people of faith who are struggling with doubts would read it. I kind of had people like you in the back of my mind a lot while I was working at the keyboard over the years. Because once you start on that road, it's kind of difficult to get off of it. You reach a point where you kind of cross a threshold and you're seeking truth. And if you get to the point where finding out the truth about whether or not God is real, whether that question is more important to you than the comfort that comes from believing that you'll get to live forever in heaven with your deceased loved ones, or the comfort that comes from being in a church family, which is, you know, very important to some people. If you want the truth so much that you're willing to risk all of that, then you've done something pretty brave and difficult. And it is a real struggle for some people. I understand that. I went through it myself at one point.
So you were a Christian, and then did the transitory thing into agnosticism, and then became an atheist? Was that your journey?
Yeah, sort of. It happened to me when I was in high school, and
no one knows anything when they're in high school. Come on.
Well, you're kind of at a transition phase there. That's about when your hormones start to flow and your brain changes a little bit, and you start to think for yourself
yeah.
a little bit more. And for me, I kind of started to step out of the religious tradition that I had been indoctrinated in, and just kind of look around. And when you do that, if you can step above what you've been indoctrinated in and look around at the world's religions, the first thing you notice is that there are many of them, and they're very different from one another. They contradict one another, so they can't possibly all be literally true. And the next thing you notice is that they all have, or most of them, have pretty extraordinary claims about miracles happening and a magical invisible beings with supernatural powers and oceans being parted so that the chosen people can walk through. Things that we don't see in real life. These things never happen in real life. So the next thing you think is, well, maybe all of them are false. Maybe none of them is true. And then the third thing that I noticed anyway is that every single human culture has this. Every culture has something that we would all recognize as religion. So that is a very profound observation. That means there's probably something biological behind it. There's probably something innate behind it. And we know now from twin studies that about half of the tendency to become religious is from genetic factors. So that's very strong evidence.
See, here's the problem is that I can see, like, I'm actually going through the chapter titles of your book, and they're just so intriguing. The problem is that people wouldn't pick up your book because they would hear you. Some people wouldn't pick up your book because they would think, oh, he's got a bias. He's got a bias. He's an atheist. He's got a bias. Well,
yeah.
I think that would be a mistake because you cover some fascinating. Why is God a creator? Why is God not female? Why are priests not female? Why do believers pray? Why ecstasy and violence? What about godless religions? Why are there atheists? Innate knowledge is the core of human nature. Faith is tenacious because it's addictive. An embodied self reads the minds of others. God's presence is a drug-free hallucination. Drugs. Are we all born atheists? I mean, you cover so much in this.
Yeah, too much to talk about here, I'm afraid.
Well, it is, and I feel like I've just gypped you off as far as time, but it is one of those things where I wanted to put it out there for people to consider picking up, to consider buying, because I think it would be a shame for people to say, well, he's an atheist, I don't want to read what he has to say about God. Because this is so much more than a book about God.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, actually. It's a science book as much as anything.
Yeah.
There's a lot of interesting science that's been done that's sort of peripherally or directly related to religion. There are a lot of pieces of the puzzle to put together.
Is there a God instinct? Is God an evolutionary byproduct? Is God a virus? Is God a figment of our cognition? Why is God a cruel tyrant? Why the obsession with death? I mean, man, you're covering every conversation I've ever had at every pub I've ever gone to.
Well, thank you. I don't know if mine is as entertaining as your pub talk, but I did my best.
No. Well, this is good. I am so glad. Listen, first of all, thank you for listening to our show. Dr. John C. Wathy is the author of The Illusion of God's Presence, The Biological Origins of Spiritual Longing. This book is being published by who again?
It's Prometheus Books.
Okay.
It's in bookstores, and it's on Amazon. If you Google the title, you'll find book reviews and stuff like that. So
I'm going to call you Jack because you're my buddy now. Jack, thank you. Thanks for being part of our show today. And it just feels unfair to stop there, but you know, because there's so much more. But obviously, we've got to move on. But thank you, Jack. I appreciate it very, very much.
I'm It's my honor and my pleasure. Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Johnny, come late.